Welcome to MicroCollege, a podcast exploring innovative, place-based, and humanly scaled responses to the crises in higher education, meaning, and discourse in our time. Everyone knows that colleges and universities are at a breaking point, but what can be done? I'm Jacob Hunt, the director of Thoreau College, a microcollege in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Join us each week as we tackle this question head-on.
Welcome to MicroCollege. This week on the podcast, we are really excited to have a thinker and a philosopher, a scholar of higher education, whose writing and thinking I've been really enjoying getting to know about. Zach Stein studied philosophy and religion at Hampshire College, and then educational neuroscience, human development, and the philosophy of education at Harvard. While he was a student at Harvard, he co-founded what would become Lectica, a nonprofit dedicated to research-based, justice-oriented reform at large-scale standardized testing in K-12, higher education, and business. He's published a couple of books, one, Social Justice and Educational Measurement, which was based on his dissertation, and it's about the history of standardized testing and its ethical implications. His second book is Education in a Time Between Worlds, which I've been reading and spilling coffee on and making notes in and really enjoying a lot. This is a book expands the philosophical work to include grappling with the relations between schooling and technology more broadly. He also writes for peer-reviewed academic journals across a large range of topics, including the philosophy of learning, educational technology, and integral theory. And maybe I could ask if you, Zach, if you could just say a little bit about the sort of projects you're involved with right now so I don't mess them up.
Yeah, there's two main projects. One is work, which most people know through the Consilience Project, which is my collaboration with Daniel Schmachtenberger. And Consilience Project is essentially an attempt to grapple with the sense-making crisis on the way to grappling with the larger meta-crisis of civilization. And then adjacent to that, I do work at a think tank, which is just renamed itself as the Center for World Philosophy and Religion. And that's the work I do with Gaffney, Mark Gaffney, and Ken Wilber, which is foundational rethinking of what philosophy needs to be in this planetary age, and foundational metaphysics and meta theory, theory of knowledge, yeah, and value theory. So those two projects co-occur. And I ended up stumbling out of philosophy of education and into something like catastrophic risk mitigation and existential risk, the study of existential risk. When I saw how bad the standardized testing system had become in the United States, I realized that you could build an infrastructure with good intention to try to make something, to try to heal something, and yet it's making the problem worse and you can't recognize this. And this was a dynamic that was identified by Joseph Tainter in the study of civilizational collapse. And so I stumbled into this field, and my work with, you know, Gaffney and Schmachtenberger and Ken Wilber is at that foundational core of thinking about what civilization is, what it ought to be. And so that education is at the root of that question.
Yeah, you can see the line from where, from there to there from your other work. So it's not surprising. Yeah. They go to that civilizational level is already what you're talking about in the context of education. So, well, we're so glad to have you on today. Really excited to talk to you about your ideas. Here on the MicroCollege podcast, we always begin with biography. So I'm wondering if you could reflect a bit on your life when you were in that early adulthood phase, 18 to 21 years old, the kind of age of students that we're working with here at Thoreau College. Where were you? What were you thinking about? What were the big influences on you at that phase of life?
let's see. I'm what they call a high achieving dyslexic. So did not do well in high school. I mean, I did well enough in high school, but I didn't succeed by conventional standards in high school. and that's when I started to focus on standardized testing and how unfair it was. because, you know, my nervous system literally functioned differently. And in graduate school, when I studied neuroscience, I looked at dyslexia and realized, oh, it's an understandable neurological difference that would have been selected for specifically preference of peripheral vision over foveal vision. That's another conversation. But so I didn't identify as a book learner or a student. I identified as a musician in high school, in part to protect my identity from the way it was being, I thought, mischaracterized by the testing and other approaches to education. I had wonderful teachers who helped me do that and who told me grades weren't everything and that test performance didn't matter and that. So I got lucky and went to a high school actually very near Walden Pond in Massachusetts. And so Thoreau specifically and the Transcendentalists, if there was any reading that I did, it was to try to make sense of my identity, in a religious way. And so I went to Hampshire College, which was a interesting experimental college with no tests and no grades, and went there to be a musician. And it was in that context that I transitioned out of being a musician into thinking about philosophy incessantly. I was specifically trying to find my way out of the educational system. And then of course went right back in to graduate school, which was a trick. And so it's hard for me to separate my work as a philosopher of education from those early years of being very kind of alienated from the system, kind of not explicitly not buying into the system. So does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it really has emerged as an important theme in these conversations that I've been having with people for this podcast, people who are thinking about education, people who are experimenting, starting new initiatives. Won't be surprising that many of those people have stories about not having positive experiences or being self-identified in some way as having a learning disability or having been labeled in that way, whether it's ADD or dyslexia or something like that. So that is clearly a big impetus for people to think about education and to figure out how to make a difference.
It is. And I benefited tremendously from the educational opportunities that were put before me. And I had great relationships with my high school teachers. But by conventional standards, I was kind of a slacker who was clearly underperforming, et cetera, et cetera. But I also was able to separate schooling from learning. And I think that became even an important distinction for me later as a philosopher. Like even now, it's something I tell parents, very important to get straight, that their kid understands the difference between schooling and learning. And if you confuse them, then sometimes a bad experience with schooling will lead to cynicism about learning in general, which is very dangerous. So I became a self-directed learner, in part in reaction to schooling, kind of like a rebel learner, where I was reading things I wasn't supposed to read or whatever. And so that's interesting. My mom, was an educator, so I credit her with that, probably. So I don't want to make it seem like I was preyed upon by the school system or had a terrible experience. I didn't, and I enjoyed going to the library and things of that nature. But again, dyslexia was a very defining throughout grade school, middle school, and high school.
Yeah, so your connection with Hampshire, your experience there is also interesting. That stands out in your early biography. That's not the first time that Hampshire has come up in these conversations. The the current president of Deep Springs College, which is a key influence for what we're doing, is a former Hampshire professor, Sue Darlington. And so we had
Sue Darlington, yeah.
Yeah, another interesting thinker. Her work is really enjoyed learning about that too. But you know, I think in your writing, for example, in the book Education in the Time Between Worlds, you talk about teacherly authority and Hampshire is really known as a important place of experimenting about that relationship, the formality of relationship between teachers and students and just the structuring of education. So I'm wondering about, you know, what aspects of that experience you've drawn on, like what was valuable about the alternative nature of education there in your future thinking?
I mean, Hampshire questioned teacherly authority to a fault, I would say. and that was problematic. So you had, you know, now Hampshire is very different than when I went there. I went there when it was still actually crazy. And it was because of the things that went down actually when I was there, including Hampshire Halloween and a couple other things, where now they've set up things where there is tracking of student performance and, you know, learning agreements that are actually enforced and other things. I think in that context, when there isn't the easy appeal to institutional authority as a basis for teacherly authority, then actual teacherly authority can come forward when it's present. And that also something I witnessed in high school, which is like, and again, I define it in a very specific way. It has to do with an asymmetry of capacity. And it's very important that a society recognizes these asymmetries of capacity, because that's where education can occur. You know, this guy knows how to shoe a horse. You don't know how to shoe a horse. You should learn. Like, that's, and there's no contesting that. Like, so when you see that, the spontaneous, non-institutionalized, emergent teacherly authority, this is why people love outdoor stuff, because it's like, if you can't start a fire, yeah. It doesn't, like, yeah, that guy can. There's an asymmetry of capacity, and it's just very real and very useful to be reflective about. And so that stuff occurred at Hampshire. It's incredible professors and incredible peers. We're just like, whoa, like, you're actually a lot smarter than me. Let me learn from you. And this is true of music as well. In that context, I was studying music for the first couple of years and witnessed incredible teacherly authority that had no institutional backing at all, spontaneous improvisation between musicians, and lessons are being taught. So yeah, that's, I think, one thing to note. Now, if you push it too far, people get confused, and you still have people, even, I don't know if this happens in outdoor retreats, but still questioning teacherly authority, even when there is a very clear asymmetric capacity. So that's interesting. And even though I had a good time at Hampshire, I don't know what it's like now, but upon graduating, in the first few years, I didn't tell people to go there because it was crazy, you know, in terms of its ineffectiveness in transforming some students' capacities. And again, I did my Div 3, which is the final Hampshire project, on Hampshire College and its founding and the philosophy of education that went into its creation. And the most important statistic was that in the first several years, when the curriculum was first put to the test, the average age of the incoming student was 21.
Right.
Because they'd been going out and doing, you know, international work or whatever, or had been in the army or something. That, and when I was there, the average age was what, 18 or something, 19?
Yep. There's a big difference between 18 and 21, and that you really can see that in intimate settings.
Yeah, to be very, very self-directed as a student learner, which I think I was basically ready to do at that age, but many of the other students were not, and they didn't have an adjacent curriculum that could actually scaffold them the way they needed to be scaffolded. And then the whole other problem is just the student loan debt, So you're sitting there talking about the Greeks or whatever and Emerson and having a wonderful time, but you're also just
piling up.
You go into his student loan debt. So that became an interesting tension, I think, which is the economics of it. So I could just reflect on my college year. So it's like this could get.
But you can see those are all themes you've mentioned that again come up in your work, and certainly have come up in our experiment here in thinking about how to construct new initiatives in education for young adults. And so we'll get into that. I think one of the questions about teacherly authority that you talk about in general is part of this this time between worlds, right? This kind of period of civilizational crisis, meta crisis that you're pointing to, in which authority in general is people don't know how to relate to an authentic authority anymore. Mm-hmm. That's so absent. But so maybe we could step out another step and talk about this concept of being in a time between worlds, right? That's kind of a theme in a lot of your work. And what do you mean by that? And what are the characteristics of our moment that give it this description?
excuse me. I mean it in kind of a strict historiographical sense. It's a time when the basic structures of civilization are in flux. And this has happened before. The most prominent in recent memory is the transition out of the feudal system and into modernity or capitalism with nation states, right? Before that, you had the crowns and the courts and the princes and a divine authority that was granted to the regents, and that whole thing fell apart. And the 30 Years' War swept Europe, and an entire structure of civilization, an economy system, a supply chain system, a governmental system, a taxation systems were all completely transformed. And so that transition out of the feudal system into modernity, capitalism, as we now know it. So I'm saying we're in a situation at least that significant, where the very fundamental bases of the civilizational infrastructure are changing, but we're in the flux before they reset. So we're in the equivalent of the 30 Years' War now. So that's a decent analogy. Now, it may be a deeper transition to that. It may be more like the Bronze Age collapse and the Axial Age. We may be looking at an even deeper reset. But just to get the analogy, I think it just works to think about like 15th, 16th, 17th century and kind of like that, especially the 30 Years' War as the climax of it.
If people are listening to this, we're interested in a deep dive into that. I'd really recommend Zach's conversation with Lena Rachel Anderson on the Metamodern podcast about Jan Amos Comenius. Is a really important historical figure that most Americans certainly have never heard of. And the 30 Years' War is something I think most Americans don't have any. Even if they're kind of historically oriented, they don't know much about it. But it's a totally wild, cataclysmic kind of event in Central Europe that really gives a sense of a civilizational transition in radical ways.
Yeah, and a lot of it had to do with the eventualities implicit in the creation of the printing press. That what swept across Europe and reset the whole system was both the mass production of native language Bibles and the creation of these textbooks and propaganda. And then you had the printing press enabled bureaucracies that you get the East, the trading companies, right? The large, the Dutch and the British, the first capitalist organizations. You couldn't have had without the printing press enabled bureaucracies which outcompeted the kind of runner systems and the stuff that the crowns had. So comparably today, the digital, the eventualities implicit in the digital, which is just what is going to play out, is as unimaginable to us as capitalism was to a feudal serf. Is this system that is in the process of emerging here. Now it's a dangerous time, obviously, and the 30 Years' War was horrific. And a paradigmatic. So it was horrific both at the physical level, just warfare, and it was horrific at the psychological level of the displacement of identity due to worldviews in conflict and the subterfuge of these propaganda networks enabled by it, enabled by the printing press. And so there's just, it's hard to not see the analogies. And so as the basic infrastructure, social structure, superstructure stack of a civilization begins to get reformatted, the problem begins to look fundamentally educational. This is where Comenius comes in. He was seeing this play out and moved to Amsterdam and commandeered printing presses to do counter propaganda. And to put out the most influential textbooks in language learning that had ever been produced, which were literally used for 400 years, not just as novelty, but used as for 400 years. And that was innovating at the most advanced level of the technological stack, which were these printing presses, in the interest of education in a time when truly the future was open. The Dutch East India Company, and this is who Comenius dedicated his book to. These were people in the future, basically at that time, who were already working in the world to come. And so, yes, this question of what emerges, sometimes we talk about the possibilities of a techno-feudalism, but you can also have technological open societies. Right. And the possibility of actual participatory governance, but you also have techno-authoritarianism, techno-feudalism competing as world structures as well. So that's some of the theorizing that I do education in the context of, because you have to think about, okay, well then during that time, and Comenius theorized, you know, what is higher education? It's literally the pivot point to that new world, where it's incubated, as it were. And so he called for a very cosmopolitan universalization of knowledge and knowledge production.
Right, vernacular language, universal literacy, you know, cheap books and paper. You know, just lots of opportunities to engage with formal education, supported by the state and organized by all the parts of society.
Yeah, and specifically one language to unite Europe, and one kind of modality of instruction and socialization. And then he imagined the Universal College of Light, which would be the kind of like clearinghouse of all knowledge being created in civilization. Where quality control would be run and then disseminated through textbooks in this kind of cyclic knowledge production, education, universalism, which is the heart of Comenius's project. So he was an amazing thinker. And it's an interesting paper. It was a huge surprise to me. I'd never heard of Comenius.
Yeah, that I really enjoyed. You know, I've heard about Comenius, but I certainly learned a lot more from that conversation and following up on things you mentioned there. But yeah, so I think one of the things that emerges from that last change of worlds, that transition to the modern capitalist kind of global world that was arising through the Dutch East India Company and other developments at that time, was a particular approach to education that eventually came about to be what you end up calling it, you know, this reductive human capital model of education, right? It's the purpose of education is to feed the economy, right? Can you keep, say a bit more about what that's like the metaphor that has been organizing education in recent times?
Yeah, so I call it reductive human capital theory. And it's the default theory of the human and society that kind of people don't even realize they hold it because it's quite simple. It's basically the idea is that the function of education in a society is to reproduce the labor needed to keep the economy going, right? So education is seen as a sub-function of the broader economic system, which is in one part obvious. Like it has to be that. It has to be that. Always education will be what allows us to do the labor necessary to keep society going. So in even simpler terms, it's like, what's education for? It's to help you get a job, right?
It's the water in which we are swimming, the fish in which we are swimming. It requires some effort to step out of that and see, oh, that's actually what's going on here.
Right. And so in one sense, like, of course, that's obvious. Education is to get you a job. And that's why you can't argue against that. It's an incomplete idea. And it leads to a way of thinking about education reform and the financing of education, and specifically schools, which is very partial, right? So one of the things we see, and this comes from Bowles and Gintis, which whose books Capitalism and Schooling in Capitalist America, I believe is the name of the book, early book, very, very good book. They talk about this isomorphism between the structure of production, the roles of production, and the structure of education, the roles of education in a society in capitalism. So the most obvious one was like during the years where it was mostly farm labor. You had the one room schoolhouse, which was kind of like a farm for kids. Then you get the factory system, and you get the schools as we've kind of stereotyped them now as what a school is the factory, the big factory school, eventually the American high school, which is like the multiple little schools feed the big one school. And then you get late 90s, you start to get this kind of like post-industrial economy that emerges. And then you get the charter schools and the small high schools, big high schools divided into small high schools, each of them with a focus, like a startup company. So you get the kind of like Gates Foundation model of kind of globalist late capitalist, white collar school. So that's that. This example of this isomorphism shows that, okay, so the school is thought of fundamentally as the tail on the dog of the economy.
Yeah, the
That,
economy changes and there the school follows after. Yeah.
yeah. And so it's like as the economy creates new jobs, that then maybe we'll start to teach kids to do that, but maybe not. So what I'm suggesting is something that's a flip, because what that's led to, which is what occurs in most extractive economic models, which is ultimately what that is, where you're taking from the resource for the end of let's say a company. So you're degrading the human substrate, like you can degrade the soil, or like you can degrade the atmosphere or the water through industrial extraction. We talk about the limits or the kind of like planetary boundary conditions, which just we can't extract or pollute beyond certain boundaries that you start to get problems. There are similar boundaries within the human psyche. And so if you instrumentalize the educational system enough to the needs of the economy, you can create an educational system, which is what happened with No Child Left Behind, which becomes too corrosive to go through. It's too difficult. So then it starts to backfire. The machines break, and you have to take it apart and see what happens. So that's, I think, the situation we're in now, which is why I'm arguing that because it's a time between worlds, we have to, in a sense, rethink the foundational organization, the foundational infrastructure or institutional basis of education, which so I call for the end of schools. And it's obvious in K-12 that you can do this kind of decentralized network hub model with pop-up classrooms enabled by kind of like AI time and skill sharing networks. So there's a bunch of things to talk about there, but the model applies to higher education too. That in the sense that it's going to be a qualified decentralization of knowledge production and the kind of a multiplicity of locations for advanced education emerging out of this decentralized educational hub network. Because the schools as they exist now, especially as we get advances in robotics and machine learning, the schools as they exist now as feeders of human capital into the economy, like as that is their basic metaphor, which is like, okay, if you succeed in school, you get a job that makes you live a life that's happy. it just won't be you can't maintain that ideology in the face of what actually exists. So you're going to have a delegitimation of the schools, which is already occurring.
Well advanced.
Which COVID sped up. Mm-hmm. And so then people pull out into these decentralized networks. And this is the homeschooling movement now. And depending where the politics go with the K-12 system and what the states do, you'll have people moving actually moving physically to get into legal districts where they can pull their kids out and then distribute it spatially.
That really is something that I'm seeing in real time, very mm-hmm. active here. This is a place here in southwestern Wisconsin, Viroqua, our little town here, that people are moving to do all kinds of different educational experiences, including what we're doing with the college and the folk school here. So that's a powerful image, this idea of this decentralized education hubs. And you know, the other image you have is the kind of the staffing of those hubs are citizen teacher scientists, right? Mm-hmm. It reminded me of something from this really interesting, I guess you could say, meta-theoretical book, but also very practical. I'm wondering, have you heard of a pattern language? Christopher Alexander and...
Yes. Yeah, Christopher Alexander. Yeah, The Timeless Way of Building.
Yeah. There's an image in this book, and this is largely a book about architecture and design, but it also is thinking about all sorts of social arrangements, particular arrangements. There's a description, and really drawing from Ivan Illich in this book about a, you know, a decentralized kind of basically a city as a university, right? Mm-hmm. And there's kind of an estimate there of, you know, every three or four households, there'll be someone engaged in teaching, right? Teaching something, and there'll be, you know, all of these different hubs in the city. And when I read that and also read your description, it reminded me of what's happening here, right? There are so many people are engaged with teaching something mm-hmm. in their homes, all kinds of different spaces. And so I think it really is a realizable idea, especially education, an appropriate use of technology certainly could help it quite a lot.
Well, that's the thing, is that we're right now at a place where augmented reality specifically is going to change the educational landscape again. Is the smartphone already disrupted it? And if we started to use them right, they could appropriately displace schooling. Right now, they're basically destroying adolescents' brains for other reasons. But augmented reality, which would basically be wearables like glasses and other headspaces, allow for incredible pedagogical innovation in skill uptake. So imagine a whole bunch of tasks like working on a car where you put these on and you look at the engine and the engine's revealed through augmented reality and you're walked through actually operating on the car by the glasses. Similarly with tours of the forest and other things. So it gets to be this place where the baseline availability of educational technology will so obviously displant the idea of like sitting at a desk listening to a teacher. And so that means you're going to be not having any reason to keep these kids locked in buildings all day, which means you're going to have to route them through their towns, their cities, their locations. Not that you wouldn't have places where they can get together, but it's obvious that, you know, so it's going to be how long will we try to keep them trapped in rooms of with kids of the same age, like under a certain kind of supervision, which is a very strange, which didn't happen. Like that didn't happen in the feudal system. Like back to the time between worlds, like it was capitalism that did that age segregation as a function. And even early one room schoolhouses were not age segregated. So yeah, we're seeing a radical disruption of institutional form. The delegitimation now for political reasons, once coupled to these technological innovations, you're going to see something very interesting happen. The hope is that resources are reallocated from governments and businesses as opposed to their resources keeping the old system locked in, which would be a huge problem.
A lot of inertia in existing systems, a lot of friction there.
Yeah, a lot of friction.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that image of that the differences between different forms of education connected to economy and lifeways is really easy for me to understand here. I mean, we have a really active Amish community. In fact, right now people might hear some clunks and bonks. We've got Amish people working on the building that I'm in, but they have basically a one room schoolhouse, and which also means a lot fewer days and hours of school. Mm-hmm. School only goes up to eighth grade, and you know it's clear that school is only a small part of the education. Most of it is happening in the home or on the farm, yeah, right?
Exactly.
You know, that is, you can see, is very effective for their economy, right? For the way that the technological system they're working with, and very thriving kind of a community we can see every day. But you know, I think another powerful idea that's related to this that in your work is, you know, this kind of the existing model of the reductive human capital kind of metaphor for education. You present, you know, a different metaphor, a metaphor of education as, you know, as ecological stewardship, right? The mind, not as a computer or as a steam engine, but the mind as an ecosystem. That's an idea that I could say is already influencing the way I talk and think to people. So can you expand on that? What does it do if we think about the mind as an ecosystem?
Yeah, the mind, well, there's a couple ways to get there. What's the basic metaphor we use to describe the mind? This is kind of what the section is about, because we're in a world where we talk about the mind as a computer. Like Freud talked about it as a steam engine.
Right.
We're talking about it as a computer. Even in the vernacular of people who are not cognitive scientists, they still talk about getting downloads and having bandwidth, and even the way we think about memory and other things, usually on analogy with computer. And then you get into the cognitive sciences and the neurosciences, where it's not a metaphor, where they're trying to actually ontologize strong computationalism as a foundation of understanding mindedness, which is a mouthful, but basically amounts to a reduction of even scientific theorizing about the mind to the limits of computationalism, which also means the limits of a binary, which also assumes non-biological computational substrate as a possible location of mind. Very different from what most psychologists would be willing to take on board. I think if you're trying to understand the mind, you have to think of it first in biological terms. The first thing I do here is reject the mind of as computer metaphor. Like perhaps it's useful for some explanatory strategies, but clearly we are not computation. And what that means is that you can't think of the mind in simple quantitative architectures. So like, for example, the IQ. This would be similar to like random RAM, right? Or like computational power, some simple quantitative representation of an architecture that says, basically, this is the thing. So that kind of reductive simplicity is rejected when you take a biological view, because the biological system is dynamic and unpredictable. And the number of variables that would be necessary to fully capture the dynamism of a biological entity is much, much greater than a computer. Good biologists know you put some measures in an ecosystem, but these are like little tiny things. And then so that's the first bit, is that you're dealing with not some complicated simple architecture, dealing with a truly complex dynamical architecture where measurement doesn't yield prediction. And then you also have to think in terms of evolution, growth, transformation, and nonlinearity. So the mind as a computer, you're either smart or you're not smart. You either have a high IQ or you don't have an high IQ, right? Whereas the organismic view, what you have is an evolving, adaptive, nonlinear system, which means that you get unpredictable behavior in novel contexts. And you also have longer term transformations that yield qualitatively new things, like new identity structures, new value systems, other things that emerge at the high end of psychological functioning. So don't get me wrong, there's fast thinking and slow thinking, if you will. And much of the fast thinking you can do metrics on and do some prediction. But that's the lowest common denominator of mind. What I'm talking about here is the conceptual self-identified mind, the slow thinking, reflective mind, where the most important education occurs. So that is organismic. And so what that means is you're an evolving ecosystem of interrelated skills, concepts, ideas, and states. You're not at some developmental level, nor are you identified with some unified intelligence or capacity. And the organismic model suggests that the educator's goal is not to fix or augment, right? So if you're operating on a computer, then you would essentially somehow write in some code and augment the nature of the thing, almost as a causal intervention into a mechanical system, where you, if you do this, you will get that output, right? Whereas with the biological system, usually what you're doing is trying to observe the dynamic of the system and then steward or shepherd or nutrify or enable, as opposed to intervene, let alone precisely predict. And so this is that metaphor of the educator as environmental steward, or educator as gardener. Now, this is actually a pretty classic metaphor in kind of John Dewey-like kind of progressive education. It's this kind of radically child-centric whole person approach to education. And so that's true. But the main difference here would be that in my view anyway, there are real dynamics to learning that can be observed, which do therefore put constraint on what student-teacher interaction should be like. So I'm very much saying, yeah, mind to the internal dynamic of the student, But I'm also saying, note what that dynamic is and what therefore it needs. As opposed to just watching it, letting it do what it will do, there's this question of what ought it do? And there will always be some guidance. Even with plants, there will be, that needs to be pruned, actually.
Like what we're doing here right now is some pruning.
Exactly. That's,
it can be kind of shocking, right? To people, you know, to like, gosh, we're going to cut all of that off, right? Or castration, like different things you do with animals, like that, that intervention is, you know, that's an important part of stewardship, actually.
Exactly. Dewey said something like, that limitation of freedom is warranted, which allows for greater future freedom. So again, this is a mouthful, but he's basically saying, like, don't limit students' freedom. When you do, you must have in mind that this is going to open future freedom. So it's like, okay, kid, I know you don't want to learn the alphabet. You'd rather run around in the mud or whatever, but I'm going to sit you down, little kid, and you're going to learn the alphabet. I'm going to limit your freedom now because I know that as soon as you get this alphabet, a whole range of freedoms open up for you that you would not have. Reading's a great example of that. It's like, it can suck to learn to read. Wait until they really want to. Even then it can be hard, but once they get it, then it's like, boom, it's a disproportionate amount of freedom opened through that uncomfortable constraint. So this question of when to prune, when to step in and put structure is key. It's very key. And that's why the teacherly authority dynamic is so subtle, because there are times when the student doesn't know exactly what's good for them. And so there's a kind of trust and a kind of responsibility that needs to be held. And we don't quite have the cultural and institutional containers for that right now. Because that requires non-institutionalized moral authority, which is hard to build, which cultures do spontaneously build, but our institutions tend to bureaucratize the authority structure. So there's a lot to say there.
I think points to the last big topic that I wanted to be sure to ask you about, which was the spiritual dimension, right? You don't shy away from talking about spiritual teachers, and you know, I know that esoteric traditions of various kinds have been things of your interest in the past. Mm-hmm. Comenius was an esotericist, and I guess, you know, this question of moral authority and this kind of leadership has often had a connection to religious and spiritual dimensions. Mm-hmm. I guess, what is your sense in this emerging, you know, decentralized, this new ecosystem of education that you see? What is the role of spirituality, of religion, and of this, you know, here in the micro college kind of movement we ended up just talking about, meaning centered or you know, kind of the inner development aspects of education?
Right. If you take education broadly construed as a social function, before schooling there was education, right? Cavemen had education, like tribes had education, the Egyptians had it, like, so there's always been education. Most of what that education has been about has been what we would now call religion. Like the predominant, so education's role is to make you able to step into society as the elders now hold society. They will die, someone must become the new elder. Education brings you into the fold of this project of living together, of civilization. And for most of human history, most of education, or at least the foundational bits, especially the bits where we'd say we are doing education, those things have been religious, by our standards now religious. So it's a remarkable experiment, actually, to separate church and state and to put education specifically in a domain that is not religious. And for a while, the American civil religion and certain forms of nationalism kind of stood in place of, let's say, that as a source of meaning. But now that has faded. Thankfully, the vast majority of most of the world is just religious. If you go to India or Africa, you have just, you know, religion. But in the West, it is interestingly difficult, I think, to have certain conversations, which humans have always had about, like, for example, what happens when you die? What is the meaning of all this? Why is this here?
I talk about that on your own time. It's not doing anything.
Exactly. And who are these religious? Like, who's the Buddha? Like, what was Christ? Like, which of course those are Thoreau's topics, right? And Thoreau's an interesting example of like a autonomous Western individual kind of like pulling from a spiritual marketplace. I mean, he's reading the Bhagavad Gita in translation through printed material that probably came from Europe, right? And maybe even Emerson's library. But the point being that, yeah, we inherit the maybe unique privilege of not being born into an inescapable tradition, many in the West. You can take a religion, you don't have to like be born into one. But that also is a displacement. It's a displacement. And so I believe that as the schools come apart and we get that decentralized, emergent education, we'll see a very clear resurgence of religious and spiritual bases for those. And some will be just what most people call kind of fundamentalism. This will happen. But we will see a lot more other innovative, higher order, synthetic, emergent religious cultures, I believe, this is occurring. So the inevitability of some world religion is interesting. We talk a lot at that Center for World Philosophy and Religion about a neo-perennialism. Mm-hmm. Perennialism being what Thoreau was onto, actually, that all the religious traditions have been, you know, men touching one elephant. Men sick is what it, you know, but this is the nature of it. And so that view that there's a single truth, you know. So if you have the unique privilege of not being born into a tradition, you're displaced, but then you can orient towards a perennialism, as Thoreau did. But there's many, 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 many things running interference between us and the clarity of that truth that Thoreau was trying to get at. So the first order of business is the sacredness of your own awareness and attention. And so when one is feeling called to a religiosity, get off the internet. Yeah. Just get off the internet. And get books and people. And if you do consume media, consume long form media, because a lot of what we're seeing now that's called the meaning crisis or alienation and depression and these things, at the base of a lot of that is emotional effect of attention dysregulation, full stop.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so this need for long form training in long form attention is a basis for, and so this is why Buddhism is an interesting doorway in, because the foundation is meditation, but you don't need to do Buddhist meditation. You can just read a book, a simple lo-fi book for 45 minutes straight, right? And then longer. Those kinds of things, I think, are the basis of the stack of the religious and spiritual exploration. Otherwise, you get distracted up into weird beliefs and psychedelics and all kinds of stuff. And I'm not saying there aren't weird beliefs that are true and psychedelics are great. I'm not saying this is bad, but I'm saying you need to get there very deliberately and very contemplatively.
If you don't have the attention to pay attention to your visions, then you're not.
Yeah, that's right. You're like, it'll come and go. And so you need to be able to have that long holding of attention. And in our culture, that's actually a radical act, an extremely radical act, because the base right now of extraction on the planet is not diamond mines and rare earth minerals and things. It's actually your attention is the most precious thing that's being extracted for other people's profit. So I wish adolescents would understand this, because then the biggest fuck you to the man is to be able to just control your own attention and not be taken by the man's social media, basically. So that would be also my reflections on the spirituality, is get your own attention straight before you start, you know, going up and out.
Yeah, that certainly is one of the reasons that I've been taking inspiration from Henry David Thoreau. I think that, you know, really early on in our kind of American experiment and the kind of the real acceleration of technology, he, I think, was sensing this and devised his own educational like experiment in working with your attention, right? What he was doing at Walden Pond was making some really conscious decisions about what he was going to pay attention to. Some books, him in his inner life and nature, right? In this really profound way. And you know that when we read, you know, I read Walden and I read it with students, like it is, you can follow that trajectory in the course of that book, right? He starts by all this stuff in the world and the newspapers and the neighbors, and by the end he is watching the snow melt.
Yeah, exactly.
He's watching, you know, and so that is definitely something we try to build into our curricula here. This week, we're in early March, the snow is melting and things are getting muddy. The students are off for 5 days in a cabin, basically on their own, solo. And I've been checking in with them, but you can see that kind of, you can see mental health improving actively. Mm-hmm. and attention, you know, is really palpable from day to day. So
yeah.
I think that's the core.
Yeah. Yeah, and Thoreau was definitely, I mean, dealing with his own mental health. Like, he had to get away into this cabin and be able to focus and get at what was most important, and that was key for him. And so, yeah, so you gotta respect your own attention, and I appreciate it. This has been fun. I appreciate it.
This is a beautiful, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for your time and for sharing these ideas with us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.